You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Among the characters in John Sayles' new novel, A Moment in the Sun, are the assassin of President William McKinley, Mark Twain, a noted critic of American imperialism himself, Damon Runyon, the author of Guys and Dolls, who served in the Spanish-American War, and Alexander Manley, editor of the Wilmington Daily Record, an African-American newspaper whose offices were burned to the ground by the Red Shirt. There are also African-American and white soldiers fighting in the Philippines and cameos by Theodore Roosevelt and William Randolph Hearst. Sayles' novel, A Moment in the Sun, blends vivid human portraits with historical events and brilliantly captures individual voices. There are just fantastic scenes and amazing dialogue in this book. A superb novel, noted Kirkus Reviews, as grand in its vision as one of President McKinley's dreams. The San Francisco Chronicle noted of the novel, Sayles' breathtaking precision and attention to detail can make E.L. Doctorow's historical novels look puny and slapdash by comparison. I like that one. Of course, John Sayles' name is synonymous with the development of independent film in the United States. Beginning with his first feature, Return of the Secaucus Seven, his movies have helped define the other that exists beyond Hollywood. He has directed 16 feature films, including Not in Order, Madawan, Brother from Another Planet, Eight Men Out, The Secret of Roan Inish, Passion Fish, which won Sayles his first Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay, Lone Star, Men with Guns, and his most recent movie, Honey Dripper, which starred Danny Glover and was released in 2007. John Sayles began his career as a storyteller, as a writer of fiction, authoring the novels Pride of the Bimbos in 1975, Union Dues in 78, nominated for the National Book Award and the National Critics Circle Award, and Los Gusanos in 1990, and short story collections The Anarchist Convention and Dillinger in Hollywood. And it is his fiction which we will focus on tonight, as Sayles discusses his new novel, A Moment in the Sun, with Howard Rodman, a professor of screenwriting at USC's School of Cinematic Arts, who has served as the artistic director of the Sundance Screenwriting Labs. Howard is also an accomplished writer. He wrote the films Savage Grace, August, and Joe Gould's Secret. He last interviewed Lady Antonia Fraser for Aloud, and we are so pleased he could join us again tonight. In February 2010, John Sayles began shooting his 17th feature film, the historical war drama Amigo in the Philippines. The film is a fictional account of events during the Philippine-American War and is due to be released this summer. And this novel, A Moment in the Sun, is set during the same period as Amigo in the Philippines, Cuba, and the U.S. John Sayles was recently honored with the Ian McKellen Hunter Award for Lifetime Achievement by the Writers Guild of America, among his many other accomplishments. Please join me in welcoming John Sayles and Howard Rodman to the LA Public Library.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, everybody. A Moment in the Sun takes place between 1897 and 1903 and is about pretty much everything that happened in those years. It's a really big book. The Philippine-American War is something that most people don't know about. It's actually how I got into this story, which was running into it when I was doing research for another project and wondering why I had never heard of it, and I was 37 years old, and getting suspicious that how do you make a whole war in which probably a million people died disappear, and why do you do that? And suspicion becomes interest, and that led me into the story. What happened, how we got into the Philippines, we, including the President of the United States, William McKinley, had never heard of the Philippines when we started into this adventure of the Spanish-American War. And it was kind of an offshoot. And this is a chapter that is written in the style of kind of the John Stewart of his day, who was Peter Finley Dunn, who was a newspaper writing from Chicago, whose method of satire was to have world events discussed by two stage Irishmen. And I have a character in the book who is kind of borrowing quite liberally from Peter Finley Dunn's style. The two characters who you'll meet in this who are narrating it are O'Malley, who's an Irish cop, and Dolan, who has the job that most of my Irish relatives had when they first came to this country, which was, in the days before automobiles, shoveling horse shit off the streets, which there was quite a bit of. So it was a good job, and you usually moved on to the police force after that, which my relatives also did. William McKinley is still the president, so this is actually set in 1899. And Mark Hanna, who is mentioned, who was a senator, who was William McKinley's Karl Rove. And in fact, when George Bush said that his favorite president was William McKinley, it's probably because Karl Rove told him there was this couple just like us. And the other thing that probably, just as a groundation before I start to read, is that all this beginning of American imperialism was very, very racially charged. This was a time when even James Weldon Johnson, who wrote Lift Every Voice and Sing, was writing coon songs to make a living. The mentality of the world, and not just the United States, but the United States included, was extremely racialist, as it was called in those days. And when we started to help the Filipinos fight against the Spanish, there was this moment when we had vanquished the Spanish in a one-day, actually a half-day battle that was a fake. The Spanish were so afraid, they were surrounded by the Philippine people who they had been lording it over for 300 years, and they secretly contacted the Americans once they got ground troops there and said, look, we'd rather surrender to you than these people who are really pissed off at us. So if you guys will, you know, bomb this parapet at 7 o'clock, we won't be there. And then if you come here at 9 o'clock, we'll shoot, you know, where you just left. And so it was only the generals knew this, but it was a fix. And in a half a day, the Americans marched into Manila, raised the American flag, turned their guns around, and told the Filipinos, who had been taking the rest of the country, if you try to enter your own capital city, you'll be shot. So the chapter I'm about to read takes place in this period when we vanquished the Spanish, but we're not quite sure whether we're going to leave or stay or what we're going to do with the Philippines, which, as William McKinley said when we took them over, I don't know if that's a line of canned goods or a country. Current events. 'Tis great news from the islands, says Dolan. Victory has been won at a pittance. The haughty Dago vanquished with barely a show. Manila is ours, then, queries Officer O'Malley, jiggling his keys. For the time being, it is. The stars and stripes gallantly flapping over the palm trees. The downbeaten Spaniard shipped home with his tail betwixt his legs. Whether we keep the place or not, that's another tale altogether. The Philippines, thousands of islands it is, from the size of the old country down to some not bigger than Battery Park, each with its complement of grateful salvages. We've enough salvages already, frowns the roundsman. Or have you never strolled through the Tenderloin on a Saturday night? It's markets we want, Pat, or so says the power behind the throne. Mark Hanna himself, is it? An appetite with legs and a mighty repository of balloon juice, but a genius when it comes to the spondulics. When the president does a jig, it's Hanna that's pulling the strings. Markets in Manila, muses the officer. If it's exotic goods I'm after, I could easily stroll over to Chinatown. We're not to buy from them, explains the horse follower. They're to buy from us, as well as the Chinamen and the Japanese and the whole gang of yellow monkeys as they've got over there, providing a positive outflow of resources and a generous influx of the old roly-poly. And can they afford it at all? We're only discussing the cheaper sort of goods, O'Malley. Nothing you or I might purchase. Have you seen the suit that's hanging in Jaime Ziff's store window? Now, what would a naked savage want with a cheap Jew suit? You'd be surprised. I've been reading enough on it. Did you know that in certain of the islands, the majority is Catholics? Well, they're all Catholics on Skelly Michael back home, says O'Malley, in a more salvage, poorly dressed lot you've never seen. The idea is, Dolan continues, to bring them the fruits of democracy and capitalism first, which produces a desire for the finer things in life, like shoes or newspapers or whiskey. The policeman appears distraught. Is there no whiskey there at all? None that I've heard of. My admiration for our boys in uniform increases. Think of all them barefoot Filipini boys who could be out rushing the cans for the working men or shining the shoes of them what has shoes. Unemployment is a terrible thing, but instead have naught to do but hang about and kick the coconut. A terrible thing. Don't I know it myself? You think if these new automobiles was within the means of any but the Astors and the Bandervilts, no more horses. And without horses, what's there left staming on the streets for yous truly to shovel off into a wagon? So it's democracy, is it? Will they be sending Croker over? Not the Tammany brand. That'll come you later. No, I believe it's Jeffersonian democracy will be the first dose. The lucky devils. It's all part of a natural progression. First, you had the concept of eminent domain. Then it was manifest destiny, and now we've got benevolent assimilation, which leads inevitably to capitalism. Plant the desire to improve your lot, and then install the 12-hour day. How long is their days at the present? Sunrise to sunset, and not a moment of it spent in gainful employment. Mostly, they run errands for the friars. The policeman winces in sympathy. Franciscans, is it? Ah, the poor, suffering brown bastards. Aye, Franciscans, and of the acquisitive variety. No, Franciscans aren't the worst of the orders. They'll go easy with the rod, is my experience. But your Christian brothers, oh, sakes, them boys, you set them boys on them and there wouldn't be a Filipini left standing. The copper ponders for a moment. So, we keep the flag fluttering above, induce them to buy our cheap suits, and in the course of time introduce the finer concepts of patronage and quid pro quo, which is the very thing that Senator Hanna advises. A sound course of action. Ah, but there's a serpent in the garden. Wherever you've got palm trees, there's sure to be serpents crawling about. This one's name is Aguinaldo, an Italian in the Philippines. And is he an anarchist as well? He's only a Filipino insurrectionist, is all. One of their generals that was on our side against the Spaniard, and now perhaps he isn't anymore. That quick, is it? Imagine, if you will, what the poor monkeys are thinking. Here they've been fighting against the Spaniard since shortly after the flood, and in steams Admiral Dooley to knock the tar out of the Dago's flotilla. Our boys to the rescue again, just like at San Juan Hill. Ah, but there, the Cuban insurrectos had their own flag at the ready. Many's the time I've seen it hung outside the junta office on New Street. And the Filipinis might have had some sort of banner waiting, for all I know. But the race goes to the swift, or in this case, to them that's got the great white fleet floating in the harbour, set to bombard Manila with dynamite. So, there's a bit of a dust-up around the fort. Morphy, the policy banker from 12th Street, says it was in the bag before a shot was fired, and he ought to know. And poor Aguinaldo and his Starworth companions look up to see the scar-spangled banner itself wavering high over the walls. You say the battle was not on the up and up? Do you know Finnegan that works for the gas lines? He's felt the hard end of me stick more than once. And do you remember last August when his missus set out after him with a lead sash white in her hand? And Finnegan run into the station hollering bloody murder. Yes, and him no great friend of the boys in blue. He'd curse us to hell as soon as look at us. Aye, but at the moment he was in mortal peril from a far more terrible enemy. Can you imagine falling into the hands of Big Annie Finnegan in all her fury? A fate worse than death itself. Well, them Spanish dons trapped in the fort in Manila was thinking the same thoughts as Finnegan. Better their casters thrown on a quick boat back to old Madrid than their noggins on a pike in Manila. Which means this Aguinaldo is in Big Annie's boots. He takes a smaller size, corrects Dolan, but the principle is the same. He goes to Admiral Dooley, does Aggie, and he says, in Spanish now, for that's what the educated ones speak, none of your Google lingo for them. He says, thanks for your help in the matter, he says. And when exactly will you be pulling anchor? And the Admiral strokes those great white chop warmers he wears, and he says, you'll be informed when any consensus has been arrived at. Being a polite way of telling the little monkey to bugger off. So, it's our boys with their kit and rifle versus the salvages with their bolo knives waiting for the other brogan to fall. And will they lift the man's tonsure, the Filipinos? Worse than that. They've got tortures and depredations to make a red engine blush for shame. There's bows and arrows involved. Spears even, like your African headhunters use. Oh, it's a primitive type of conflict they'll be wagering on them islands. What the Royal British who's fighting the Boers in Pretoria are calling guerrilla war. Guerrillas too, a terrible thing, O'Malley ponders. What exactly is a Boer then? I've heard of the thing, but I don't have my finger on it. It's a type of Dutchman, says Dolan, that's gone wild on the African veldt. That's a sobering thought, that is. A salvage Dutchman. The worst of two worlds. Speaking of red engines, says Dolan, me own opinion is that what's needed over there is General Miles, late of the great victory over San Diego, Cuba. Him that induced Geronimo and his heathen band to come back on the reservation. He's the boy for the job. Aye, the policeman nods. He'd make short work of this Aggie fella. He taps his stick absently against the wheel of Dolan's wagon, thinking, so, when the Filipinos have been subdued, do you think we'll have another star in the flag? Not on your life. The Filipino himself is something between a Hottentot and a Chinaman, with none of the positive attributes of either race, whatsoever as those might be. Them islands is more likely to become a territory like this Puerto Rico or Oklahoma. As such, they enjoy some of the benefits of citizenship, but keep their noses out of trouble come election day. It seems like a great deal of bother to go to, opines the lawman, to sell a few cheap suits. 'Tis the white man's burden, replies Dolan, bending once again to his task, and we'll all need to buck up and carry our portion of it. Thank you. So if there was any ethnic group I didn't insult there, my apologies for leaving you out.
We'll get to the rest. The evening is long. The first thing I remember reading of yours was Union Dues, which was a novel that was set in 1969 and very much of 1969, mm-hmm. but came out, I think, you know, a decade and change later. And there's Los Gusanos, which covers a 20, maybe 30-year swath of Cuban history. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in your films, things like Eight Men Out and Matewan. Mm-hmm. As a writer, you seem most alive when you can dive back into the past, when you can write about stuff and supply the grain and the details and really evoke the way it was. And I'm trying to figure out, what is it about diving back into another era that inspires the writer in you?
You know, I've written a lot of contemporary things too, but I think the thing that's special about whether it's a screenplay or a book, writing something in a period, is I'm always, you know, what kind of motivates me to write things is always this question of, if this is the way people are acting, what can possibly be going through their heads? And when you write characters, you know, for a screenplay or a book, one of the things that you realize is that nobody starts from scratch. You know, they have their personality or whatever and their tendencies. But we all come with a certain amount of baggage. People take a look at you, and depending on your age, your sex, your height, your color, whatever, depending on where you are, they're going to react to you in a certain way. No matter who you are, you're going to be fed certain preconceptions of the world. You're going to be handed a package from the media, or if it's pre-media, from your family or your oral tradition, this is how the world works. And so how you react to the world is not just based on you being a human being, but all that other stuff. So one of the fascinations for me writing anything, period, is, you know, whether it's a short story or anything else, you have to say, is this before Freud? Yeah. You know, not because after Freud, people all over the world started actually looking at each other differently and interpreting other people's behavior differently. Is this before or after the women's movement? Is this before or after capitalism? You know, is this before or after the Catholic Church? You know, whatever those things are that affect the way you see the world. Where am I? So, you know, in something like A Moment in the Sun, one of the things that I'm trying to do is see all this history, this 5 years of history, which to me is about the last nail on the in the coffin of the Reconstruction period and the beginning, the real beginning of American proud imperialism, you know, where we're actually admitting it and saying we're going for it, we're going to be a player. But seeing the way that somebody who's caught in a flood sees it. So each character is just somebody trying to keep their head above water and look for something to grab onto that's floating. And they might have their version of the flood. But if you put together 35 to 40 in the case of this book, maybe the reader gets to get a better picture, like an overview of where the flood went and what it did.
As Louise was saying before we came out, there are a number of grand historical personages who are in Moment in the Sun. There's, you know, a lot of writers. There's Mark Twain and Damon Runyon and publishers like Hearst and Pulitzer and Arthur Brisbane and political figures like Pitchfork,
Ben Tillman yeah.
Who's a, you know. But at the same time, the texture of the book really isn't about great men. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hear in my head that, you know, the Gang of Four song, it's not made by great men.
Yeah.
It's about the people who are working physically to build history, who are the folks who are making it with their hands and legs, not the folks who are sitting in offices and deciding their fates. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, how do you figure out when you're writing how to keep that balance between the folks who are actually building the future with their fingernails and the folks who are trying to decide the fate of everybody else?
Well, one thing is that while they're doing it, even the famous people are just doing their job. You know, most of them aren't really aware. You know, Soapy Smith was just a con man. He wasn't aware that he was going to become a famous, iconic con man. You know, even the president is just trying to get through the day, and he's been told, here are the people you have to see, and so you have to deal with him as a bureaucrat. Right. Who gives a certain number of hours a day. I mean, McKinley used to actually once a week just have people come in and shake his hand, which as it turned out was a bad idea. but, you know, he agrees to see people and he shows up in that case. So one of the ways is to whenever you're writing great men or great women, is they don't know that they're great men or women, and maybe nobody else does yet.
So Topsy the elephant's just looking for the next peanut.
Yeah. And you know, occasionally Teddy Roosevelt, even in his day, was a caricature before he even got really big famous. You know, he just looked like a cartoon. Cartoonists loved him. And so I realized at some point I couldn't write Teddy Roosevelt without him seeming like a caricature. So I followed Teddy Roosevelt by creating this vaudevillian who looks a lot like him and plays him on stage in these little skits, who starts way down at the bottom of the bill when Teddy's just, you know, the undersecretary of the Navy. And then as Teddy gets more and more famous, this guy moves up the bill and at some point decides, I'm not going to use the spirit gum mustache, I'm going to grow a real one. And finally, he's like a headliner.
His name is Teethador, and he's one of the great characters in this book.
Yeah. So the balance really to me is, the characters who I want to follow are just people lost in the flood. And you just want to know, are they going to, you know, you realize more than they do. You've got more analysis than they do as a reader. And you're just hoping, oh my God, what's going to happen to them next? You know, and to me, that's the essence of storytelling, is that you have to have that thing. Even if somebody who really knows history and knows more than I do about this history reads this book, there's characters there and they say, oh my God, doesn't he know what he's going into? I want to know what happens next with this character.
Yeah. One of the things that clearly occupies you is that historical moment. You know, there's that quote from W.E.B. Du Bois, which I think is part of where the title comes from, which is, the slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back again towards slavery. And as I think you so nicely explained, this was also the moment where American imperialism owns it and says, you know,
this is who we are.
This is who we are, and it's a good thing. Yeah. And if you don't like it, tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you then keep your figures from simply being the reverse-engineered icons and avatars of the larger political themes and make them really see the world in their own subjective way and make the reader take the journey with them, thinking of them as who they are, not what they represent?
Yeah, one of the things that I've included, for instance, the thing that I just read in it, is a lot of, okay, what was the media of the time? What were people being fed? All the humor was ethnic and racist humor. That was it. That was the coin of the realm. So you get to see a minstrel show. You get to hear the stage Irishman talk about politics. Every once in a while you meet a cartoonist or an illustrator. It was the golden age of illustrators. You'll meet a correspondent who's working for Hearst or Pulitzer or whatever, and you'll get their point of view. So a lot of what you do is you try to put it together in a mosaic form with a lot of narrow points of view, with a lot of people who have a very narrow agenda, and they can't see the big picture, but you hope that your reader can connect the dots, that the characters aren't necessarily connecting. The one character who's a bit of an exception to that, even though he only has one side of the story, is the Filipino character, Diosdado Concepcion, who's somebody who, you know, his when he's a spy, his nickname, you know, for spycraft is Argus, he who sees all. And he's somebody who, just because of the places he gets to see the backstage of an awful lot of Filipino history. But at the end, he gets kind of pushed out of the inner circle, and he ends up just being, you know, a threadbare lieutenant running a little guerrilla outfit in the woods with a bunch of guys who don't even speak Spanish, which is the language of the educated in that day. So he ends up actually in a place where he's just trying to live out one day after another and have his guys survive from being this guy who was privy to the information in the back. So a lot of it is, I think as a writer, when you're writing something, there's always that question of whose point of view are you going to see this through? Who's the most interesting point of view? For instance, I always loved the idea of the spear carrier. You know, you'd see these movies with, you know, Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn, and they're in Elizabethan clothes, or she's queen something, or he's king something. And there's some day player, probably not even a day player, probably an extra, you know, and he's standing there where all this stuff is going down, and you figure he goes home, you know, and he says, you know, Mary of Scots is in deep doo-doo. To his wife, you know, but he can't say anything in court because, you know, that'll be it. So what's his point of view? He's got an agenda, which is not the same as theirs. And he's probably saying, the shit's going to hit the fan and there's going to be another big war. And I hope I can keep my gig here just standing by the throne and don't have to go out and get killed in it.
Yeah. In Raymond Chandler's Farewell, My Lovely, there's a point where Philip Marlowe and Moose Malloy are going looking for Velma, and they go to a bar where Moose remembers Velma used to work, and the neighborhood has changed, it's very different, and they're the only white people there. And they go looking for Velma, and the guy behind the bar says, Velma don't work here no more. And Moose and Philip Marlowe exit. And that's just one glimpse of a different Los Angeles. And somebody like Walter Mosley comes, turns the camera around 180 degrees,
and
shows you a world where it's about the guy behind the bar, and every once in a while, some of these clueless white guys will walk into frame and out.
Yeah.
And I think that's...
Say, how do I get to the Staples Center?
Yeah. But one of the things that I think A Moment in the Sun does really well is in the scenes with all of these profound personages, you know, the you know, presidents and the assassins and you know, the McKinleys and Shoglash. How do you say
Shulgash.
Shulgash.
Leon Shulgash, who shot McKinley.
Yeah.
Or Goulash, as he's called by some of the characters.
Yeah. Right. But if, like, you're showing Goulash, you'll also show the jailers. You'll also show the other people in the cell. You'll also show the lives around it. And I admire both the discipline it takes to do that and the energy with which the minor characters in your book are never minor, because when you're with them, that's the world that you care about.
You know, it's the thing, there's a great story. There was a character actor years ago named William Redfield, and he told this story. He ran into a friend at a party in the late 40s and said, "So what are you doing?" And he said, "I'm in this really interesting play by a new guy. He's got this crazy name, Tennessee Williams, and it's called Streetcar Named Desire." And the guy said, "What a weird name. You know, what's the play about?" "Well, where do you play in it?" And he said, "Well, I play a doctor who comes all the way from Baltimore to help a lady in distress." And it's this, if you know the play, there's a doctor who comes and says, "Come with me," at the end. And you feel like, okay, she's going to go to the loony bin. And then Redfield said, "And what's the play about?" And the actor said, "It's about a doctor who comes all the way from Baltimore." And as an actor, which I've been, when I talk to actors, what I always try to tell them is, I want the audience to feel like if the camera followed you, you're a day player, you got your bit to do, you're going to walk off screen, and we're going to stay with the main guy. But I want the audience to feel like if the camera followed you, there would be an interesting story there, and that you're going somewhere, and you've got your own life. And you have to play the scene that way. What do you want in this scene? You're not there just to stand in Jack Nicholson's shadow or whatever. You've got to have your thing, and then the scene will work. And that's what I really find, you know, especially in fiction, that I'm able to do, is once I put my money on the... And every once in a while, these characters will cross, and then you can, you know, kind of hand one of them half the chapter and the other half the chapter and see how they see the world differently. Is once you're with the guy, you're with the guy. And it's a lot of it is really having an ear for how they speak and really thinking out. If any of you have ever seen Anna Deavere Smith's work, you know, she tapes things verbatim and then she does the people, and what she does is doesn't edit them. You know, she finds the poetry and how they express themselves. And you've got to find that for your characters. And then the other thing for me is that it's not all dialogue. And in the chapters from Diosdado's point of view, how does he express himself when he's describing things? Or we're seeing things through his eye. How is that different from a character who's illiterate or who's African-American or who's Irish or who's an immigrant or, you know, who's a... you know, a dastardly Southerner who's got his own, you know, kind of, you know, underhand agenda. You have to find those ways of expressing yourself, just as you do in a movie, but in a book you can do it so many more times with so many more characters.
One of the things that your characters are fascinated by and that you're fascinated by writing about, and I think as a reader kind of really hooks us into your novel, is there's an extraordinary sense of process. Amazing sense of just physically how the world gets built. Mm-hmm. I started making a list of, if you only had this novel and you had to survive in the world, you would know how to deliver a baby, how to find food in the Philippine jungle, how to protect your personal belongings in the Yukon, how to roll cigars, how to deliver a baby, how to operate... Ooh, that's twice. Operate a linotype, hop a freight, load and unload coal from a boat, traction a broken wrist, drill holes in the roof of a mine, wrap your fists prior to a prize fight, arrange your troops for a charge up a hill, and cure gonorrhea.
Actually,
and that's just the beginning of it.
Try to cure gonorrhea. They actually, in those days before antibiotics, they just tortured the guys and let them out and said, "You're cured," and they weren't. So,
yeah. But I want to talk about the joy that you take as a writer and that we therefore take as a reader in learning how things are done. The details of, well, in linotype there are the brass letters and then there's the poured lead that it gets pressed into.
Right.
Or if you're in a mine, this is what you want to drill the holes in the roof. How do you find that stuff? And once having found it, how do you make it live so it doesn't seem like you're just got two screens open on your computer?
Yeah, well, the important thing is, I remember Studs Terkel's book Working, which is a great book. At the beginning of it, there's this quote from somebody that says, you know, the only thing you do for 8 hours a day besides sleeping is work.
And that was when the eight-hour day came in. Back then, this is like 12, 14 more. In the Philippines, they still got the 24-hour day, 24 on, 24 off in the film business. So it is part of who you are. It shapes your body or misshapes your body. Yeah. In the case of one of my main characters, Hod Brackenridge, is just lucky that he gets, you know, kicked out of the mines because he's an organizer, because otherwise he'd be dead in 3 years from, you know, silicosis. Because of the job he's doing before they shot the mud up in the Burley drill. You just breathe this dust in and it tore your lungs apart. So one of the things is that it's part of who you are, and your body will be shaped different,
right,
and the way you see the world will be different because you're doing this stuff all day long. The other one is that for me, it's a way of characterizing people. One of the things that you try to do when you work, I'd never call them non-actors. When I work with new actors, whether they're kids or just local people or in one of our movies, is it's really important to give them something to do. And one of that thing is because they start to be, if they're not, you know, trained actors, they don't know what to do with their bodies. You know, they remember their lines. They might even be able to play the character. But if you give them something to do and say, okay, look, the really important thing here is you're hanging up the laundry, and we're going to mix all the stuff up in the laundry basket, but when you put it up, I want all the blue stuff first. Yeah. All of a sudden, one wave of self-consciousness has been taken away because they actually are doing the thing. They've actually got to really look for the blue things and do it. What I find with my characters is that if you can put them in that work situation, not only do you know something about where they're coming from, how hard their life is, what that work is, but as far as the chapter goes and the rhythm of the chapter, it will have some of the rhythm of the work. And it's a very useful thing for your chapters to have different rhythms, to have the work have different rhythms. You know, and some jobs are great because you don't have to think, and some jobs are great because you do have to think, and you have to separate those kind of things. So very often, somebody who's been drilling forever, you don't have to think a whole lot. You hold the thing up, and you drill until somebody taps you on the leg, and that means that the bit is dull, and they're going to change bits. And you do that until the rod goes in so far, and then you're ready to put the dynamite in. Well, you've got hours to think about something else. When I used to work in factories, I could write while I was running machines, you know, and they weren't life or death machines. There were no cutting edges, or not many cutting edges. But whereas when I worked in a hospital with people, I couldn't write in my head because I had to deal with human beings. All that stuff, I think, gives you some texture of who the people are. My favorite case in this one is there's a character, African-American character, Jubal Scott, who's a drayman. This is, you know, 1900s before automobiles, so he's like the equivalent of the great mechanic on the corner. You know, he's like a horse whisperer. You know, he makes his living, you know, as an independent, is like a guy with a small pickup truck who dumps loads around town would be today. But he's got to know about horses. And one of the things I had to know about, and was great, I didn't grow up with horses. I grew up watching Westerns, but it was like, oh, the big red horse and the pinto horse and the palomino and all that kind of stuff. So I had to learn of, if I'm going to mention the horses that pull a fire engine, what kind of horses did they use to
right. So you got your Clydesdales and you got your Percherons.
And the Percherons, what colors do they come in? So I don't say a color of Percheron that anybody who knows anything about horses say, Percherons don't come in that color.
Yeah.
So I got to read a book, which I recommend to you all, called The Color of Horses. Great book, written by a veterinarian cowboy who just got fascinated with the same thing. Of why are horses the color they are, and which ones start out white and end up black, or start out black and end up white? What are they good for?
I want to go from talking about the very physical and visceral sense you have of the process of work that your characters go through. And I think you're right, the physical toll it takes on their bodies. I mean, people's muscles ache. Mm-hmm. People get diseases all the time. You've got a character who ends up losing a limb. You've got a character, you know, by the end of this book, the marks of history are written on the flesh and writ large. Mm-hmm. So I want to go from that to talking about your own process, the damage you do to yourself to create books like this.
Writing is fun. You know, I'm sorry. You know, I know people who suffer through this stuff, but writing for yourself when, you know, I'm a screenwriter for hire, and, you know, I like it. I like, you know, most of the people I've worked with have been really great, but finally you're working for other people. You're a carpenter.
You're trying to help them get a green light for their story. And after about two or three drafts, the politics come in, and you're still trying to do a good job, but the reason you signed up to do it might be gone by now. They may have chickened out of that or changed their idea, or a hot actor comes along and they say, well, instead of 45-year-old woman, we're going to go with a 20-year-old. Yeah. And you have to adjust to that. Whereas when you're writing fiction for yourself, it can go anywhere you want it. So really for me, it's like just fun. I did this book. If anybody really ever does a study on me, which I don't recommend, what you'll see is that my last two novels came right after protracted Writers Guild of America strikes. And I had a period of enforced unemployment in the movie business, in which I had the time to finish novels that I had started years before and only been able to, kind of drop the needle once or twice on.
Well, as an admirer of your fiction and a member of the board of the Writers Guild, maybe I can help you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. About 4 years.
Right, exactly.
I need to work first.
But I still want to know all of, what Holden Caulfield calls that David Copperfield kind of crap or that Paris Review interview stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what happens when you get up in the morning and where you go and what you write with and how you sequester that part of your day.
I'm lucky in that I forget what I write very quickly. I'm used to writing several different kinds of projects, sometimes one of my own and one for somebody else. One might be the first draft of something and one might be the last polish on something else in the same week, if not the same day. And quite honestly, I can switch from the 1900s to the future like that. I read three lines and I'm in that different world. So it really depends. When I wake up, it's, do I have anything due? And should I work on that first? What's due first? What should I get done? And what I like to do with screenplays is write them right away when I've just gotten the notes or the impetus from the people who are paying for it, and then do that in a couple of weeks and then just let it sit, do other things or don't do anything, and then read it a couple of weeks later. And it truly is like, who wrote this? And sometimes it's not pretty. And sometimes it's like, oh, that's not bad. I could, I didn't say this. Somebody said that the purpose of writing is to have something to rewrite.
Yeah.
So I go back and I see this thing and I say, yeah, I see why this guy got fired, but I could really do something with this. There's some things I can keep about this thing. And with fiction, I can write anywhere, I can write...
In a car, in a bar.
I don't drink, so it's usually not in a bar, but I've been in bars and written. I can write on the back of something that somebody gives me if I get an idea. I can write on a typewriter. I'll run 3 miles, which takes me about a half an hour. Occasionally, when I'm in the middle of writing, I realize, okay, I just thought up 6 ideas, and I can only remember 6 ideas, so I have to shorten my run and step back and keep doing, or else I'm going to forget one.
Yeah.
But I do feel like if it's a really good idea, I probably won't forget it, so I don't have to write things down right away. Maybe I'm wrong, and I've forgotten some really good ideas, but I don't think so. I'm lucky in that way. I don't have to read the other stuff over. I'm going to go through the whole thing and rewrite it. One thing that works for me actually is to handwrite stuff or type it in a kind of shorthand and then type it out the full version, and that really becomes a draft. There's something about seeing it in type that makes it different. And then one thing I do with my screenplays and my books is I read everything out loud, especially the dialogue and screenplays. Screenplays, I don't read the stage directions out loud, but I read every character as if I had to play it. And what that helps with your ear is you actually hear it. And first of all, you make the person consistent. Second of all, you make sure your characters don't all sound the same. And thirdly, sometimes you just realize, if I was an actor and I had to play this, there's a little bit more, if one more thing, one more connection, and I'd really have a three-dimensional character here. And so in this book, there's like 4 major, major characters who get 150, 250 pages each. It's a really long book.
And with them, when I finished the first draft, and I with the computer, took out this one character stuff, put it in chronological order, took out the second ones, and I read each of those four guys if that was the book,
yeah,
to make sure it was consistent with itself.
And that it tracked. And,
yeah, and that there was a consistent arc to it, and then put them back into the book. And occasionally there was something where I'm spelling something differently or the rhythm was a little off, and then you can make it consistent.
One of the things that you're often praised for in your fiction work, and I think in your screen work as well, is having an ear for dialogue, which mm-hmm. I always think is an unfortunate phrase. It means, mm-hmm. I think people think it means you just sort of, you know, go to Starbucks and listen well.
Mm-hmm.
And what it really means is you make shit up great. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
although I can the little bit of journalism I've done, I realized I can remember 3 pages of dialogue verbatim before I have to write something down.
Wow.
I got to cover the 1980 Republican convention for a magazine back when they let the reporters down among the delegates. And, you know, so I carried a little, you know, I wasn't from the New York Times because they were so hip they didn't carry anything to write with, you know, or pads. But I carried a little pad that I hid. And I just walk and kind of eavesdrop. And after about 3 pages of dialogue, I'd run and scribble this stuff down. And then I'd go and eavesdrop some more stuff. And it was great. You know, it's a great kind of skill. But also, it just jumps out at me when it's dialogue worth recording. I actually had two guys come up to me in my first short story collection. There's a short story called Golden State. And I was hitchhiking around the country. And I got to Ventura, California. And I was on the beach for a day. And these two street guys, these winos, came up to me. And one's name was Cervantes, and the other's name was Daniel Boone. And they basically talked a short story to me, and then, because I helped them out to get a jug of wine, fell asleep on the beach, and I went and wrote it.
Wow.
Which is, you know, that doesn't happen often, but somehow they found me.
The last time I was in the presence of the names Dante, Cervantes, and was in the dog park, actually.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Where you get, yeah. I'm going to read a couple of lines of dialogue from this book that I just loved. A waif and a dog may both be referred to as canines, but there, a wolf and a dog may both be referred to as canines, but there is no confusing the two. Ain't been the bullet made that can bring me down. Yeah, but they making new ones every day.
Good. See, I don't remember these lines.
So you
I haven't
can reuse
read
them.
This thing in a long time.
Yeah. How do you figure out the kind of just technical stuff of, like, how many lines of dialogue you can run before you have to have a he said and she said, how you break up your paragraphs, how you want to orchestrate the rhythms of mm-hmm. this sort of short staccato chapters becoming longer and then speeding up toward the end of each of the three books in here?
Well, reading out loud helps. So for instance, what I just did there is slightly edited, but you know, there is the concrete poetry of the page, so you can kind of tell. If the people speak differently enough, you can tell who's speaking.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had McSweeney's gave me an editor on this, a guy named Jordan Bass, and that's a lot of what we went over. Was him kind of every once in a while saying, I think we need a he said or she said here.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a lot of what I ask of an editor is have them be a good reader. And if they get lost, and this is somebody who reads a lot more books than I read, then somebody else is going to get lost, and that's a good thing to know. The other thing that I really liked about him as an editor is he said the golden words that every writer wants to hear, which were, I think we need a few more chapters here. There's about 4 chapters that were kind of connective tissue, you know, and it's so much more fun to write an original than to rewrite something you've already written.
This thing that I've got on my wrist used to be called a watch. Mm-hmm. Now, because of things like you've got on your wrist, it's called an analog watch.
Yeah.
So this, what you wrote, used to be called a novel.
Mm-hmm.
But now, because of other stuff, it's now, well, this is actually now a 19th century novel, or maybe a 20th century novel,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, a novel like Dos Passos, or Steinbeck, or mm-hmm. Beethoven, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Do you pay much attention in ways that either inspire you or terrify you to current literary stuff? Do you just write the way you write? Do you deliberately set out to write a novel which could in some ways have been written in the period you're writing? Or is it just you sit down and that's what comes out.
You know, I get interested in the story and I start it off and then I want to know what happens to the characters. So a lot of my process is like what I hope is going to happen to the reader, which is I didn't know that it was going to be this big ass thing. You know, I started with one character. It was actually a screenplay first, years before, that we realized at some point we'll never get the money to make this thing. And then when I decided, oh, that could be a novel, you know, I should read that thing over again, and I got into a little bit more research, I realized, well, here's an African-American guy who's in the, you know, the regular army, and he's in Cuba and the Philippines, but there's all kinds of places he can't go that I want to know about, and I want to take the reader there.
Yeah.
So I need this character, and where can he go? And this character, and where can he go? And this character, where can she go? So that grew. I have to say, I don't get to read as much fiction as I'd like to. I mostly read it for work when I'm writing screenplays, you know, for background or people want to adapt it or whatever. And you know, the last book I had was, what, 15, 17 years ago. So every time I come out with another book, I don't know anybody in the publishing business anymore. They've all moved on or retired or whatever. So it's just not my world.
Right.
So I don't have to worry about it.
So you're not in some aggressive or polemical way saying, I'm going to write a non-postmodern book. You're
no,
just
the world
books.
Just passed me by, and I didn't notice.
Every once in a while, we get lucky that way.
Yeah, you know, but I also think that, you know, our last movie out, Honey Dripper, is about a guy who's a blues and rhythm and blues guy, and all of a sudden rock and roll shows up. And his big choice as a character that Danny Glover plays is, okay, I can certainly play this stuff. Technically, it's easier than what I've been playing before, but do I want to? And some of the blues and rhythm and blues guy says, I'm not getting on that bus. I know it's leaving and everybody's going on it. I'm not going to do it. And they stayed with the blues, or, you know, a few even stayed with rhythm and blues, and really their careers dwindled to almost nothing. Another guy said, yeah, I can play that shit, and, you know, it'll be fun. I'll make some money and da-da-da. And they went on the bus. I think you, at some point, just say, here's something I want to do, and the world's going to do, you know, this didn't cost me anything. It cost me my time. Unlike a movie, which costs other people's time and a whole lot of money, even a low-budget movie costs a whole lot of money, this isn't that kind of project, you know. So it's a funny kind of hobby, you know, in a way. And, you know, if you read about some of the old guys, I wasn't a literature major, but, you know, a lot of the guys who they teach in courses, it was their hobby. They worked as a customs inspector or something like that, and that was their gig. And then when they had some time, they worked on this thing that was really fun and then tried to get their friends to read it.
Yeah. Speaking of customs inspectors, mm-hmm. There's a line that Herman Melville wrote in Moby Dick, which I've always adored, which is Ahab toward the end, and he's addressing Moby Dick directly.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Thou all-destroying but unconquering whale."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know of any better description of either America at the period that you're writing about it or America now.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about Melville and thinking about this book, and then because I do have that other screen open, you know, reading about the 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 wars we're currently engaged in, reading about a presidential candidate who can refer to the president as the food stamp president.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Does it give you great glee, great horror, recoil, and disgust, or you just don't care that this novel, which takes place at the turn of what is becoming the 20th century, reads really, really intelligibly for readers in 2011?
In a way, it's unavoidable. I mean, it's not just America, it's human nature. It happens in this case to be America. The Philippine-American War, we got, you know, 3 recognizable things. One was the word boondocks, from bundocks, which means mountains or the place far away. Amok, you know, soldiers going amok, you know, and allegedly the .45 pistol was invented to knock the amokers down before they could get to you with their bolos. And the water cure, which we now call waterboarding, first appeared then. The Anti-Imperialist League
which was, you know, the most famous people in it were Andrew Carnegie and Mark Twain, was like the precursor to the anti-war movement during Vietnam. But, you know, you could have set this in France, in Algeria, whatever, and you're going to find those situations whenever you have one country occupying another. When, you know, people have to sell wars. The first person you have to sell a war to is yourself. And human beings find a reason why God says they have to do this. And it's, you know, is the last line of that bit I read comes from Rudyard Kipling, who wrote this poem, Pick Up the White Man's Burden, Send the Best Ye Breed. And the subtitle of that poem is The United States and the Philippines. And it's his open letter to the United States saying, we Brits have done our job. We've carried the ball of imperialism. It's not your opportunity. It is your white Christian duty to sort these little brown buggers out. Yeah. And the last line is, and those silent, sullen people will thank your gods and you. There were ministers who, you know, could do 2 hours on why slavery was God-mandated. Human beings, whatever they do, they're going to find a reason why it's okay. In fact, it's really good for the other person that they're screwing.
Yeah.
You know, we've managed to do that.
Well, I mean, is there anyone in any period in history who has ever started a war who did not say it was in the name of freedom?
Yeah, or their natural right. You know, Liebenstraum, the, you know, whatever, the Asian cooperative society that the Japanese did, that there was some reason why this was okay. So you sell yourself, and then you have to sell everybody else. One of the interesting things about the Spanish-American War is it was a war that was more popular with the young people than the old people. The young men of the time, there was still that idea that to prove yourself, you had to go to a war. And there just weren't enough people of other colors to kill left in our country. So all of a sudden, there was the Dagos. And they were off-white, you know. And so we could go to Cuba and feel good about liberating the poor Cuban people who needed liberating. But then some of them got the bait and switch, and they ended up in the Philippines killing Filipinos trying to take over their own country, you know. And you know, that one of the interesting, a lot of the research that I ended up really leaning on in this were not the overviews, the historic overviews, because historians tend to have their agendas and, you know, do a kind of summation of this is what this all means, but diaries and letters home from soldiers. And you could find, occasionally would find three guys from the same exact unit, you know, the same, you know, the Nebraska Volunteers or whatever, and one would say, you know, this shooting goo-goos is just like a rabbit hunt. I've never had more fun in my life. The second might say, hey, I signed up to be a professional. You shoot who they tell you to shoot. It's hot and it's nasty, but I'm here to do a job. And then the third one might be horrified by what he's doing and say, I didn't sign up for this. This is exactly opposite what America should be doing and that I thought I was doing, who has some analysis about what's going on. You know, that's three different people from the same state, from the same background very often. So, you know, I think that the whole interest for me is that, yes, most of the world is buying these things, but there are people who don't, who actually question the official story, no matter when it is. I'm sure there were guys fighting for the Roman Empire saying, what do we need this for? You know, what are we in Gaul? You know, what is, you know, what does it do for us? You know, it's lousy duty, and you know, we should take over Greece and leave it at that.
Yeah. I think we've got time to open it up to some questions from the audience.
Yeah. Somebody with a microphone.
I would say that person over there. And while the mic is going to them, while we're thanking people, and while you're applauding, you might also want to thank yourselves by joining the Library Foundation of Los Angeles tonight. It would be a lovely thing to do for yourself, and it wouldn't be so bad for these kinds of events either.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for coming tonight. Thanks. I have a question about the writing process. I'm wondering, when you sit down to write something, do you generally find you go from point A to point B when you sit down, you're writing towards that? Or do you find along the way the characters kind of take control and hijack it to point C, and when you get to the end, you realize, oh, that's what it's about. It's not about what I originally sat down to do.
Yeah, that can happen. And in something like this where there's a lot of research, it can also happen with your research. I have a hard and fast rule that because research is fun and it seems like work, but it's not really work compared to writing, I limit myself to 1 week, no more, of research before I have to sit down and write some fiction.
Wow.
And so I'll have an overview of where I'm going. I'll come to a chapter and say, what don't I know enough about before I write this chapter? Do that research. But after a week, no matter what it is, I'll write the chapter. And then I'll have some question marks and maybe go back and do some more. But sometimes that research, you'll realize, oh, there's a connection there. Or I didn't know that, and that's going to take me in a different direction. And sometimes, quite honestly, the characters do. You just realize at some point, oh, you know what? I'm not going to just leave this character here. He's going to show up somewhere else. And what if this guy shows up? You know. So, and some of that is just technical. Some is just like, okay, rather than inventing my 47th character, maybe I'll have my 43rd character show up in three different places. And, you know, but some of it is really, you know, they don't talk to me. I'm not mystic about this stuff. But every once in a while, you know, like anybody who's an actor here, when you improvise, sometimes something comes out and it really is like the character did it because you're, you know, well, when I'm writing a character, I'm writing in that character. I'm writing from their point of view. And every once in a while, you know, I get dialogue coming and those lines pop out that I don't remember, but I'll take credit for them. And the person will say something surprising, you know, and then you say, okay, let's go in that direction. There's a great novel about an artist, and I can't remember the name of it, but it starts with a guy who's a clerk, and he is writing, the horse's mouth, and he you know, he's got the old-fashioned pen, and there's a blob of ink on his ledger all of a sudden. Instead of just getting another piece of paper, he starts pushing it around. And this is like 9 o'clock in the morning. And the next thing he knows, somebody says, see you tomorrow. And he realizes a day just went by like that because he's been pushing this ink blot around. And he realizes, that's it. I'm going to do this. Whatever that was, I'm going to find a way to do that for life. Quits his job and becomes an artist. Occasionally in fiction, as much as you plot and as much as you outline and everything, you have to just follow the ink blob. You know, and then, you know, and when you rewrite, you may realize, nope, that detour didn't lead it anywhere. And it might be great, but you don't need it. When I'm making a movie, because movies cost money, I try to cut those things off before we start to shoot, because that might be 2 days of shooting. And you know what? You got to be brutal in the editing room, and you hate to cut something that you know, was 2 days of people's work, and maybe somebody's a character who doesn't show up. You know, cut it in the screenplay, and it doesn't cost you anything.
Back there.
Let's see. By calling it the Spanish-American War, does that imply or connote that it was the Spanish who attacked the U.S.? And second part, what do you say about the tendency here in the United States now to say American, American, American? Because as a Mexican-American, we believe the word American means the continent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even United States, it's the United States of Mexico, too. I think it's the Americans, North Americans, go on this need-to-know basis, and they figure if it's not right in front of them in their country or in their neighborhood, they don't need to know. So you would be hard-pressed to find an educated Mexican who didn't know who the president and vice president of the United States are. But if you ask most of the people in this room, even who's the vice president of Mexico or even the president, most of them are not going to know. There's not a need to know. The Spanish-American War was just what they decided to call it. And because there were Spaniards involved and Americans involved. It actually only recently started being called the Philippine-American War. Before that, it was called by our history books and the history books that Filipinos grew up with, the Philippine Insurrection, as if you can insurrect. You know, it's like Flip Wilson's idea of, you know, Christopher Columbus, you can't discover me. I'm already here. you know, it is a way of thinking about the world that is egocentric. And I think most countries that get into invading other countries, they just think that way. You know, truly, the reason that the Philippines became a territory was we decided to have this fight with the Spanish. The Spanish were doing horrendous things to the Cubans. The Cubans had been fighting against them. But earlier incarnations of this thing about Cuba had been, oh, the southern states wanted to make it another state so that they would have another slave state when things got voted on. There were, you know, what they were called filibusters in those days who wanted to take it over and just take over the plantations because the Spanish were so far away, they'd be easy to beat. So when the new incarnation came, there was this humanitarian face put on it, photographs of Cubans looking like they'd been to Auschwitz, which were real photographs, were published in the newspapers and magazines. But when the debate as to whether we were going to go to war with them happened in Congress, a guy named Teller from Colorado, a senator, stood up and said, okay, you guys who are so pro-war, this isn't because you want to take over Cuba as a territory, is it? You know, this isn't like this expansionist stuff that's going on. And they said, oh, no, this is pro bono, this is out of the goodness of our heart. And he said, okay, put it in writing. So there was a thing called the Teller Amendment that said, no matter how this war comes out, we cannot end up taking Cuba as a territory. Signed it, everything like that. He was probably really worried about Cuba competing with sugar beets in Colorado, but you know, it was a good thing to do. However, what happened is nobody knew the existence of Puerto Rico, Guam, or the Philippines, and that the Spanish were there, and that, okay, while we're beating the Spanish, we might well take those away too, so it wasn't on the list. So they were ripe for becoming territories, and that's what happened to them. So, you know, it is, I think, once again, human nature, and nations act like human beings is when they get on a roll. So many of the cartoons of the day, the political cartoons of the day, are Uncle Sam with his sleeves rolled up with a lot of biceps, joining with John Bull and the French guy and the German guy and the Japanese guy and the Russian guy, becoming proud imperialists. And it was like, we're going to sit at the adults' table, finally. And we've reached that point, the march of the flag.
Okay, we've got time for two more. Are there two more here?
Somebody over here? No.
I'll ask a question if nobody else will. Union Dues, a novel that you now forget having written.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, and you probably don't know this anymore, but there's a wonderful spiritual which sort of pops up in just the first few pages. And as I was reading this, I was just taken again and again and again by not only how many songs are in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a book which is as much sung and has a tone and a melody to it as it has a rhythm. And the fact that people's spiritual yearnings in your fiction tend to find their way expressed in music.
Mm-hmm.
When people have yearnings which are too large for their bodies to contain, they sing or they hear songs. Or even if they're not singing, you're supplying the music for them. What's the role of music in your life? Can you sing the songs in these books?
You don't want me to sing the songs.
Well,
given that
we have to clear the hall.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know the melodies. And you know, and sometimes I make them up. But I usually make them up to the rhythm of an extant song, like most songwriters in the old days did. It's kind of like the old rule of thumb for traditional musicals is when the characters can't express it in regular conversation anymore, they sing it.
Yeah.
So spiritual stuff, which I think people don't articulate much in their heads, but feel, tends to go into music. Also, you know, it's what was the music of the time? What's the music of this character? You know, it's a way of driving the story forward in maybe a more poetic way, but also characterizing the people by what are they listening to? You know, what is it, you know, most of the Union songs are based on some old folk song or something like that, but once you put those lyrics to it, it gives it a totally different feeling.
Yeah.
You know, you can't blame me, I'm sticking with the Union, is a song called Pretty Red Bird, and the ice cream wagon in Hoboken, where I lived for years, would play that.
And I'm sure they didn't think of it as a pro-union song,
yeah,
because none of their drivers were unionized.
Yeah. Do we have one last question?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say I'm not familiar with your books prior to coming here. However, I saw a number of your movies, and the movies seem to be, each one is morality play, and you leave it up to the viewer what the moral is. How did you come to this form of creating your movies?
Yeah, you know, I actually don't think about that much when I'm writing a movie. Mostly what I'm interested in writing a movie is my central characters having to deal with something. The drama for me is not necessarily whether somebody gets shot or not, which it is, you know, very often that's what a thriller or an action movie is about. But somebody who we want to like, we want to admire, comes into a situation that's a really tough situation, and they have to make a tough decision. Which way are they going to go? And there may not be a good decision to make. It may not be just a good guy would make this decision and a bad guy would make that, because it's complex enough, that decision to make. And that's what, you know, that's what we live with. Amigo, which is our new movie that's going to come out in the States in August, is based, you know, on some of the research I did for this. It has none of the same characters. The amigo of the title is a guy who's the mayor of a little barrio in northern Luzon during the Philippine-American War. His barrio, his little town, is garrisoned by American soldiers who are chasing Aguinaldo, the guy I was reading about, northward, trying to capture him and end the war. And so he's got, you know, literally the lieutenant of the Americans is living in his hut. He's got the Americans breathing down his neck and expecting him to, you know, keep his people in line and make sure they don't do anything against the Americans. But his brother is the leader of the insurrectos, the guerrillas fighting against the Americans, hiding in the woods just beyond the rice fields. And who expects him to collaborate with him and help him spy on the Americans and maybe even, you know, help out when there's an ambush or something. Hundreds, if not thousands, of these guys were killed during this war by one side or the other. That happened in Vietnam. That happened in Nazi-occupied France. That happened, I'm sure, in Judea when the Romans were there. Is somebody between a rock and a hard place. And very often, that's the drama that interests me in a movie. Where you don't have as many characters, if you can find a central character, or even sometimes in the case of Eight Men Out, bunch of central characters who are put in that position where they're going to have to make those tough, complex decisions, there's a lot of drama in that for me. And, you know, we made a movie, Limbo, which has an open ending. You don't know if the people who you've gotten to kind of care about are going to get whacked or not at the end. And, you know, people... You know, back when Blockbuster was the big rental place, would bring the tape back and say, you know, the last reel is missing from this thing. The first thing I knew about that movie was the ending, which was, this is not a movie about whether they get killed or not. This is about the process of getting to that point, and that if they survive, they're going to be a family. And that's the point of the ending. And, you know, some people got it, some didn't. But I think that the thing in movies is... What traditional movies do really well is polarizing people. You know, black hats and white hats, good guys and bad guys. If you've seen contemporary movies, the bad guy has to do something really, really awful so you can kill him in a really, really awful way. Mm-hmm. And feel good about it, you know. So the audience is going to be really happy when he breathes so much helium that he blows apart into a million pieces, you know. Well, to justify that, he has to do something really, really awful. And so then the good guy has to be really, really good or whatever. And, you know, and some of the dynamic is great for comic book movies. When you've got Iron Man fighting, and he may have some flaws, but he's fighting against somebody who's just evil. You know, and he may be interesting, but he's just evil. When you get into human beings and recognizable human behavior, which is not necessarily what people go to the movies for in droves, but is something that interests me, recognizable human behavior has all these other complexities in it. And that gets interesting for me. And it's, you know, it's one of the reasons the biggest compliment I get as a filmmaker is all these really, really good actors who will work for me for scale. know, because the parts are good and interesting, and they get to explore something instead of just playing one note in front of a green screen and saying, look out, and whatever they're looking out from will be added at a future date. Thanks, everybody.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.